Hello and welcome to Series 3, Episode 9 of Out With Susie Ruffle. Hello, I hope that whenever you're listening to this, you're having a good day. It's currently 11 minutes past 10 on Sunday the 25th of April, and I'm 2021, I should add, and I'm just about to have some hot cross buns. That's what's happening in my life right now. It's been a really good week for me. I've been delighted, actually, that that me and this show have been nominated for a British LGBT award alongside some really, really famous, brilliant people. And I'm really delighted that people are enjoying the show, that it's getting out there, that it's been nominated for an award. It really, really meant a lot to me. If you want to vote for me, you absolutely can. Details are on my Twitter, or you can just sort of Google the 2021 British LGBT Awards and give me and this little podcast a vote. That would be majorly appreciated. So, as always, we received loads and loads of emails this week. I love going through them, as you all know. Some of them, people say, I don't want you to share this, I just want you to know this, so know that I have read it. And also lots of people getting in touch, always with great recommendations. I want you to know that when I get recommendations, I do reach out, I do try and get people on the show. We have got so many brilliant episodes left in this series. I'm really thrilled. Today's, I think, is really special as well, and we'll get to that in just a minute. As always, I love sharing listener emails, so let's start with one here. Dear Susie, thank you so much for the work that you do. Your podcast and your comedy have brought me so much joy and helped me feel less isolated. Thank you very much. This podcast makes me feel less isolated by talking to you lot, so I'm really pleased that it feels the same for you. My coming out journey has been very long. I came out to myself at age 21 and then found that I couldn't face coming out to anyone else, even my close friends. I should add that I grew up in a rural area and have known very few out gay people. I waited for years feeling like I was always on the verge of telling them, whilst also having a sort of for and against weighing scale, where I mentally logged any time anyone showed any homophobia, a lack of openness, or on the other side of the scale, they seemed like an ally. I was constantly deliberating whether to come out, and I always erred on the side of caution. Sure, they seemed like an understanding friend and retweeted a gay celebrity, but maybe they will shun me. I never felt comfortable, and I have since realised that it was almost entirely down to internalised homophobia. I was also really cautious about not letting people know that I'm gay, to the extent that I would make up ex-boyfriends so that I had something heterosexual to reference when people wanted to chat at work. I'm a teacher, and I was convinced that the pupils' parents would hate me if they knew I was gay. It sounds ridiculous now, and although I'm still very guarded, I have become much more comfortable in recent years. Then, in late 2019, someone at work, a close friend, started chatting casually about whether anyone on our team was gay. She caught me off guard, and in a panic, I felt that I needed to draw attention away from me. I hastily made a joke about suspecting one particular colleague of being the prime suspect. I went home feeling awful about what I'd done. I was ashamed, and I felt that enough was enough. I needed to own my sexuality with pride and stop hiding and stop being homophobic. I contacted my friend and simply came out to her. I explained why I might have come across as homophobic. It was a scary moment for me, but ultimately it was such a relief. Then last year in February, just before lockdown happened, with the support of my friend, I had a coming out spree. I'd still not ready to come out to my family, but I came out to 6 more colleagues and friends and went to a queer dance night with some of them. The lockdown a few weeks later has rather stalled my life as an out gay woman, but having podcasts like yours featuring so many out and proud people living joyfully has been a great help and helped me keep my eye on the goal to be out and proud, open and courageous, and the kind of role model that I so badly needed. With so much gratitude, Rosie. And she said that I can use her real name. Rosie, thank you so much for writing in. I think so many people have felt similarly about getting ready to come out or coming out or really getting hold of their identity. And then, of course, the world stopped and we've all been in this weird place for the last, 14 months or 13 months? And I can imagine it feeling, like you'd really stalled, like you were ready to get hold of that queer life and get hold of some queer joy. And to that, I'd just say, you know, don't worry. When things reopen properly, the parties are going to be so brilliant. The prides are going to be so wonderful. You know, and I think we've all learned a lot in this time about being more and more inclusive, and hopefully we're learning more as being more inclusive as a community. And when those nights out and those club nights and those pride parades and those marches and those protests happen, you might have felt like you've had a brief pause in time, but you know, it's there for the taking, it's yours, and I hope that you'll feel completely welcomed by the brilliant LGBTQIA plus community. Thank you so much for writing in, Rosie. Right, I've got another email. Now, you might hear me sort of stumble a bit in this one because I'm really aware with this email that I want to make sure that there's nothing in it that could show who someone is or that could sort of out someone by accident. So if I stumble a little bit, I'm sorry about that. My brilliant editor, Michael, will probably make things a bit better. But I'll just get on with reading the email, shall I? If you read this out, please don't use my name, as I would hate to publicly out someone who isn't ready for that. From the background story of me and my children, it sounds like the story of my child coming out is a complete non-event that couldn't possibly be worth sharing with anyone in the LGBTQIA plus community. And this is not praise for me being a woke mama story, but I promise you our children always have the capacity to surprise us, even when we think we have them all figured out. I would like to start by saying in my late 30s, I've only recently started to admit to other people that I'm attracted to women as well as men. I've known this since I was about 15 and had a couple of sexual encounters with girls from sixth form and university before falling in love with a man who became the father of my children. As someone who grew up under Section 28, it seemed so much easier to never mention attraction to anyone but men and let everyone assume that I'm 100% straight, as I suspect many other bi or pansexual people did up until recently. As their father and I are no longer together, and I'm just not willing to close off the possibility of relationship or sex with women or non-binary people, so now is the time to stop caring what everyone thinks. I listened to your podcast for me more to understand my child who recently came out to me, but it's helpful for that too. I've always taught my children that everyone is equal and no one should experience hatred for how, where they were born, because both of my children were born white and in possession of a penis in a wealthy Western country. We all know that that is the exact demographic most of the prejudice and hate in this world comes from. I was especially vocal about how there's nothing wrong with being gay because I didn't know who they were attracted to. However, I'm not out to my children purely because teenagers do not want to hear about their parents having sex, and I have no desire to tell my teenager I'd happily sleep with a woman if the opportunity presents itself. I've missed the years where I could have told them without them being aware of sexual feelings, so I figure if I ever have a serious enough relationship with a woman to introduce them to them, then they'll know. I said I didn't know who my children are attracted to, but that really is, I don't know who my children are attracted to until they were five. At 5 years old, my oldest told me there was a new girl at school that was lovely. Never spoken to her, but he can tell by just looking at her face. I was not prepared for this. He was five. My internal monologue screamed, no, 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 no. Come back in 10 years and tell me that. I was actually less shocked when my youngest came home, upset that his friends had banned him from playing kiss chase. He was kissing the boys and was utterly confused as to why he should ever want to kiss a girl. After telling him he shouldn't be forcing kissing on anyone that is running away, I told him I'd tell him to find clubs full of boys that want to kiss other boys when he is old enough to go. So he's gay. I'll just wait for him to either tell me or bring a boyfriend home. Cut to 10 years later. My oldest is at a local grammar school while my youngest is in an all-boys comprehensive, as the mixed school in the area is Catholic. And not what I want for my non-religious gay son, or a performing arts academy. He would rather die than be put on stage, not conforming to stereotypes, I know. My youngest is ready for school, standing in the hallway, blinking back tears, repeatedly putting his hand on the handle, and then stepping away, physically unable to leave the house. He's never been thrilled with going to school, despite being proud of how well he does academically, but I had no idea he found it that upsetting. I no longer care that he's late, I just want to know why school is awful. It's too stressful. He knows he's doing really well, and GCSEs are not the huge do amazingly well or mess up the rest of your life that the teachers make out it to be. It's not the work. He can't tell me why. No one has been unkind to him. It's because of him. He hasn't done anything he shouldn't or anything he feels bad about. No arguments with friends. He just can't tell me. He knows I love him no matter what, and he can tell me anything. He can't say it. There is something wrong with him. Not unwell wrong, just wrong. There is something wrong with him. He is wrong. Okay, this is about him being gay. I'll encourage him to say it. Tell him I didn't think his generation cared about that. It's fine. I'm bisexual. It doesn't really matter. He can't say it. Saying it makes it real. He doesn't want it to be real. He knows he shouldn't be ashamed of anything about himself. No one should be ashamed. But he is. It's not about a crush. It's not about who he fancies at all. It's not that trivial. It's how he looks. It's not his weight. It's what he looks like. Yes, He looks to me like a perfectly normal teenage boy. Exactly. My heart sank. He should look like a girl. She should look like a girl. Tears rode down her cheeks. My heart broke. I hugged her as she sobbed on my shoulder. I'm devastated. Heartbroken. I'm not heartbroken because I have a trans daughter. She didn't break my heart. I'm heartbroken because she is my baby and I can't protect her. And that is all I am supposed to do. I always thought parents being upset about their children being anything other than cis heterosexual was a lack of understanding, but this isn't that. I understand. I understand how the world will treat her. I understand how she'll have to fight to be believed, to be accepted. I have seen friends go through this, and that was bad enough, but this is my baby. I'm average in every way, in size, still holding a child that is taller than me, and well on track to being taller than the average man, but she is my baby, and I can't make anything better. And now I understand why parents of my generation, when they claimed that they didn't mind their children were gay, that they loved us no matter what, but they hoped that we weren't. Up until this morning, I thought us being gay would be the disappointment to them. We would be a disappointment. No, they didn't want us to have to fight consistently to get and keep our rights. Even with the support of family and friends, even with them standing to fight with you, the fighting is still tough. That's why I took the easy path and kept quiet about my attraction to women. I understand that. I also understand how growing up, hearing parents wish us not to be gay gave shame to so many people. So I hug my daughter a little tighter as her tears soak my shirt. I swallow the lump in my throat, blink back tears, and secretly press those that escaped into her blazer while her eyes are buried into my shoulder and she can't see my face. She has a struggle ahead of her. We have a struggle ahead of us. I was so certain I had a gay son, I didn't even think that I could have a trans daughter. Parents get it wrong. People get it wrong. I'm also aware that most trans people prefer to be called by their true pronouns when talking about things they did while they were still presenting as the gender they were assigned at birth. I repeatedly used he in her coming out story because using she throughout would have given away what I didn't see coming right from the start. Thank you for giving us so many different perspectives on life and love. I mean, first of all, you sound like the most amazing mum, and I'm sure loads of people are listening to this wishing that they had a mum like you. I hope that your daughter is okay and that she's getting any help that she needs right now. I really hope that in creating a podcast like this, where I try to make sure that I have people from all aspects of the LGBTQIA+ community, that conversations might help someone or just might help them feel less alone. Thank you for sharing your story with us, and thank you for showing what a brilliant mum looks like. I'm sending you loads of love. Right, let's go on to today's conversation. It's with my brilliant friend, Brona C. Titley. I really hope that you enjoy this. I really enjoyed recording it. I think it's a really special one, and I think what Brona has to say about shame is brilliant and remarkable and wonderful, and I mean, I say it in the show, I wish someone had said this to me when I was growing up, but yeah, it's a special one today. I hope you enjoy it. Oh, listener, I'm very excited about today's interview. I'm very excited to share this person with you if you're not aware of her already, but you should be. That's the thing, you should be. Brona C. Titley is a brilliant Irish actor and comedy writer. You might have seen her recently in Sky One's Reluctant Landlord, Women on the Verge, Tracy Breaks the News for BBC One, or ITV's stand-up sketch show. She's also a writer who has written, on kind of all of the comedy shows that are going on at the moment. 8 out of 10 Cats, The Last Leg, The MASH Report, Harry Hill's Fun Capsule, Spitting Image, and that's just naming a few of them. She's funny, she's brilliant, and she's very kind. She's also a dear friend of mine. Welcome to the show, Brona.
Susie, what a joy, a treat, a pleasure, and a delight to be here.
All of those things. First question, what does the C stand for?
Oh my God, do you know this as my dear, close, personal friend? Have you ever known this?
No, I haven't. I've just always accepted it.
It's a really fun game for non-Irish people.
I do know what it is.
You do. See if you can say it.
Cuiver.
Oh my God, I'm so proud. God bless you. Did you sneeze?
See, as you started saying cuiver, I was like, I've had a conversation.
Some dusty box at the back of your vast, incredible brain, there was the knowledge of my mid initial. Yes, it's cuiver. And I just like to sound pretentious and wanky, like Homer J. Simpson.
And for the non-Irish listeners, yeah. Could you spell cuiver for me?
Yeah, sure. It is ZS, pound sign, pound sign, hashtag, number 4, TED.
And why did you use C?
It's C, obviously, it's C-A-O-I-M-H-E.
And that's why I always, I just know that your brain are too silly. And I know your middle name's Quiver.
I know.
But I can never merge those two things in my brain.
And you're just indebted to my parents who changed my name from Quiver to Brona when I was 6 months old. So that English people like you could pronounce it.
So the scummy English like me didn't have to make any effort with your name.
The Brits are at it again.
Well, you know that I want to be Irish because of my love of Irish music.
And I am actually counting down the days until I can get you to a Titley family reunion where we just sit around with guitars and sing for 8 hours into the night, no matter how many noise complaints are made to the local authorities.
I love that. One Christmas, was it like a Christmas where you were at home?
Christmas,
and you just
yeah.
sent me a voice note because I had mentioned to Brenna how much I love Irish music and Irish singing. And just sent me a voice note of your family just doing just an Irish folk song.
And you were just, I think actually, had you seen it on like an Insta story or something? And you sent me like quite
Maybe.
A terrifying message that was like, who are those people singing and how can I be there?
Yeah, I think it was a bit like that, yeah.
And
yeah.
I was like, marry into the family, Susie, marry
in. This is actually a marriage proposal, even though you're already married, but it's going to be quite an
Thank
awkward
you
interview.
So much. Listen, we've spent a lot of time together during the pandemic and I'm fine with taking a new wife. If ever there was a good time to take a new wife, it would be now.
And we have very similar names, me and your wife, so that would keep it very simple.
That's true. It would be no adjustment whatsoever.
Very easy for everyone.
Wow.
How are you, mate?
Oh, I'm good. Thank you so much. It's genuinely lovely to spend time with you, to be on a podcast and to still be at home wearing my slippers. But I do want you to know that I put a bra on for you because that is respect.
That is respect. And I thank you for that. I thank you. So you're working at home with a little one.
Yeah, that's right.
How has that been?
Well, it's an interesting experience. Like your life kind of changes 180 when mm-hmm. you have a baby, and then it sort of changes 180 again when you have a global health crisis, and that adds up to 360. But I'm not back where I was a year ago, so the maths doesn't work out there. Yeah, I mean, in a way, my daughter, who is 14 months now, she's gained more than she's lost in the sense that she had her two mothers home all of the time, mm-hmm. And you know, gets to be incredibly bonded to both of us and really secure and all of that stuff. But at the same time, like, her head is going to explode the first time she goes to a soft play. Like, she's going to walk in the door of a soft play and be like, sorry, what? This stuff was here and you've never brought me? And then she'd be like, wait, why are there other baby-sized people walking around this? Am I not the only baby in the history of the world? So, you know, that kind of stuff has been a challenge. But then work-wise, like, obviously I work as an actor and a writer. And weirdly, I did shoot a small part in a sitcom before Christmas, and I have another part coming up. But mostly it's been writing. And I'm just so lucky that as writers, we're a movable feast. Like, mm-hmm. we can actually, you know, you can still write in your bedroom during the apocalypse, it turns out. And I did 6 months on Spitting Image last year, which was, you know, a sort of topical comedy show during this time. Like, I'm extremely close friends with some of the writers on that show, and I have not seen them from the waist down. And I have seen most of my friends from the waist down.
Well, I mean,
it's actually
something you ask for as we come into the house, isn't it?
It's right. Yeah. No, that's the first thing. I'm like, hey, good to see you, pal. Take your trousers off.
Nothing rude. It's just, you just have to wear shorts at Brona's. That's all it is.
I just like to see a pair of legs, you know. And
Fair enough.
Yeah. Worst things have happened at sea. So it's been a strange time, but I feel sort of extremely blanketed by the privilege of managing to hold on to some bit of work, mm-hmm. and then also, you know, the privilege of becoming a parent. So it's been okay. It's just been a lot.
Yeah, of course. And does that mean that your little girl hasn't been back to Ireland yet?
Well, so there was that period in the summer where you could travel if you quarantined.
Yes.
So we were, oh my God, we were so lucky. We managed to get her on a ferry, sort of wore masks on the ferry as everybody did anyway. And like, we were in our own car. We traveled in we paid £35, treated ourselves to a private cabin on the ferry. And then we just went and quarantined in Ireland and then were able to see my family. And we just didn't see anyone else while we were there. We just kind of spent time outdoors. Yeah, so they have only met her once, which is absolutely insane that I have a 14-month-old and my family, because I'm extremely close to my family and like they've only met my daughter once. But we do FaceTime every day and my parents kind of just ignore me and talk to her. So that's fine. I'm not bitter about having been replaced by this fruit of my own loins.
So whereabouts in Ireland did you grow up?
I'm from Dublin. I am a Dublin city chick, born and bred. So I grew up in a place called Glasnevin.
I was going to break into Cockles and Mussels then, please, about old Molly Malone, but I'm not going to, because my love of Irish music. No, I won't.
I really love that. That's what you think we sit around singing. It's like, you know.
I mean, you literally sent me a voice note of you, of your family singing. So please don't make out like I'm the one with stereotypes here. Like, no, you were the one that was like, oh, someone's got one of those, oh, I don't know what they're called, the drummy things.
Oh, a baron.
A baron. You're making it seem like I'm the one with all the cliches, but you're the one.
No, that's true.
You're slightly encouraging it somewhat.
We do sit around singing, but I just want to clarify that we don't sit around singing Cockles and Mussels alive-o. But we will, for you, when you come to visit.
Thank you.
Yes, I'm from Dublin and I went to university, or as we called it, college in Dublin. And I never, ever thought I would leave Dublin. And I moved to London for drama school to go to train at Lambda. And I was there a week and I was like, oh, I'm never going back, am I? Just because I've just, my whole life I've been obsessed with theatre. And then that kind of segued into comedy, and that segued into comedy TV. And Ireland is incredible. The people are incredible. The theatre industry is great. It's just that it's small. The population of Ireland is like, you know, 4.5 million. And, you know, RTE, which is our BBC, they make two sitcoms a year. And here I can work across, I don't know, four different comedy shows in a week. So it's just not sustainable to have the job that I have here. It's not sustainable. However, this year has changed everything in the sense that, like, I can actually do jobs from my bedroom now. So, you know, maybe I will do more Irish stuff. I went back 2 years ago for an amazing Irish sitcom called Finding Joy that I co-wrote the story of, starring Amy Huberman, who's a brilliant comedy writer and actress. And it was just so much fun to be in an Irish writer's room. It was brilliant. We sat around singing Cockles and Mussels alive-o. So you would
How did you get writing done?
No, the show is just six episodes of Molly Malone.
Right, and is that available anywhere? Where is, can I watch that anywhere?
I'll send you a link, Susie, because I think you'll enjoy it, actually. You'll get a lot out of it.
That's great. So when you say you thought, oh, I'll never leave Dublin, is that because growing up there, did you just love it?
Yeah, I did. And, like, I think you would agree, potentially, as my friend, that I have a bit of a optimistic personality anyway. So, like, I loved school and I loved college and I loved Dublin, and then I moved to London and I loved drama school and I loved London. So I've been, you know, I've been kind of happy wherever I've been. But I think it was just, I suppose I felt, without sounding like too much of a cliche, I felt very Irish. I felt like my identity was wrapped up in Irish theatre, the Irish language, Irish music. And I didn't think that I would need to live anywhere else. And then it was only when I sort of started to develop my kind of professional tastes, I suppose, and the scope of what was available in Ireland versus what I kind of wanted to do. And the specificity, I suppose, of my job, because, like, lots of, like, the shows you mentioned in the intro, I'm a gag writer, and I don't know how many people are making a full-time career out of being a gag writer, unless they're stand-ups, and I've never been a stand-up, but, like, in terms of gag writing for TV, that's much more doable here, I suppose.
And did you grow up, talking about feeling very Irish in the language, did you grow up speaking, is Irish your first language?
I'd love to say that it is, but that would be a lie. English is English, and I would never lie to you, Susie. Thank you.
There are other podcasts where Brona says that it's her first language.
Oh, I lie to them so much. I don't even tell them my middle name. I tell them the C stands for Katerina. So, for example, in my family, like, my dad is a professor of the Irish language and he's a writer, but we didn't speak it at home all of the time. But I come from a large family. There's five kids, so I have two brothers and two sisters. And I'd say about half of us just started to really love it and it clicked, and the other half maybe didn't love it so much. So then I began to speak Irish with my dad growing up as a teenager. And then I have some friends that I speak Irish with, like Aisling B, who, you know, she and I will speak Irish, and not just so that the Brits around us don't understand, but also for love of the language.
But that's just an added bonus.
Yes, yes, exactly. So yeah, it wasn't a full-time language at home, but it does still feel like a mother tongue, if you know what I mean.
And I didn't know that your dad was I knew he was a professor, but I didn't know that he was a writer.
Yes, he's an Irish language writer, so he's written like 18 books. You just haven't read them because they're all in Irish.
Because I'm ignorant and I refuse to learn Irish.
Which has been a real stickler in our friendship up to this point, because every time really I come to your house, I ask you to take your trousers off, and then I say, have you learned Irish yet? And you always say yes to the first and no to the second.
I'm sorry, I will try harder, I promise.
Thank you.
So is it quite a creative house that you grew up in?
Actually, it was quite an academic house. Like, I think creativity was... So my dad, he's retired now, but he's still a writer, but he's retired from being a professor. My mum was a primary school teacher. Now, my eldest brother is a university lecturer. The next sister is a teacher. The next sister is a university lecturer. Then there's me, and my little brother, who is also an actor and now a bar owner. So there was quite a... It wasn't like there was a focus on academia. It's just that academia was the kind of like vein that ran through the house a little bit. But because my dad was also a writer and his books are like very creative, I think that was kind of in... And my mom is very creative as well. It was kind of in the genes. And also I was extremely show-offy from a young age. Like as soon as I figured out what acting was, which I think I got by like watching EastEnders, I begged my parents to send me to drama class. And then they did. And then they sent me for like 15 years, like from when I was five up until like I was old enough to take myself off. So they were incredibly supportive of that.
And so when you say you were show offy, what were you like at school?
So I was a good student, but I was... Once I sort of found my voice, which I think you kind of come into your own personality a bit more when you're like 12, 13, then I think I always wanted to make a joke. So I would sort of be like, be well behaved, be well behaved, be well behaved. But if the teacher said something that was a good setup for a punchline, I would be in there so fast. So I think, and so I had a reputation with like my class for being funny, but I don't think I had a reputation of being the class clown because I was also quite good. And because I came from a family of teachers, I would not have dreamed of being like bold, as we call it. I would never have been bold, like a naughty student.
I was quite bold.
Yeah, I bet you were. It's quite like I've listened to quite a lot of this podcast because it's an excellent podcast and you're a dear friend, and also I'm nosy.
Thank you.
But like the stories of you at school is actually quite shocking. Like you were a little nightmare.
I was,
in an adorable
tricky
way.
Well, not for the teachers. I mean, some of the teachers I think, oh god, I was probably really annoying to you, and other teachers really like me, and then there are some teachers that I'm like, you were just a prick who didn't like children, and I think fair enough that I was difficult.
No, and that's really good to realise that when you become an adult, isn't it? That actually like they weren't all gods, that like some of them were very flawed human beings.
Yeah, I was also at a Catholic school and I wasn't Catholic.
Okay.
And I quite quickly went, I think a lot of this might be bollocks. And
you've just described like Ireland's journey in the last 100 years in your journey at school.
Finally, I'm Irish. But you know, regardless of sort of what I, you know, any sort of spirituality I have now, but there was certainly a time where I was like, I'm not sure what they're drinking is definitely Jesus's blood.
Yeah,
I'm just not sure that I buy it.
It's so interesting because like my whole Catholic school, like those classes, we were told, you know, and this happened, and then like he took a fish and he turned it into sushi for everybody in the town. And then I remember being a teenager and like kind of questioning these, and a teacher eventually saying, well, you know, they're a metaphor. And I was like, what? You've been teaching it as fact like my whole life.
It questions what else is metaphor.
Yes, exactly.
That she's been teaching.
Yeah. Is the science a metaphor? Well, some people actually think that, so let's not go there.
So is it quite Catholic at home?
No, it wasn't. We did go to mass, and again, weirdly, I sort of went to mass longer than everyone else in my family. Like I can't speak for the whole of Ireland, but I was a teenager in the 90s, and And there was just like a sort of a nationwide disillusionment in the church because so many cases of child sexual abuse were coming out. So many priests and bishops had secret families and secret wives. And so all of a sudden, the kind of, you know, putting the priest up on the pedestal your whole life that my parents' generation did kind of fell apart. And people had been a little bit lapsy, lazy Catholic before that anyway. So I never felt like Catholicism had a huge strangle on my life or personality, nor did it really have on my household. But going to Mass was still a kind of a ritual that we did. And I like ritual. And also I had no other language for my spirituality when I was a teenager. So I thought, well, I want to talk to someone about what's going on. I don't really know if it's the God that you're describing, but this church and half an hour on a Sunday seems to be an okay outlet for that. So I still kind of kept that up for a bit longer. And now my mother-in-law is Catholic, and my wife's mum, and I go with her to Mass sometimes, and I still really do like the the ritual of it. But I also feel like the Pope this week came out and said he can't bless same-sex unions, and because you can't bless sin, yeah. God can't bless sin. And when I saw that headline, I actually just found it a bit funny, because it was sort of like, you are living, the Catholic Church is living in a different world and a different time and bears no relevance upon the lives of so many people. And so that's just a bit sad, really. It's just a bit, like that headline was just a bit, I find it a bit pathetic, because like what you're talking about there is love. And you're saying God can't bless love. And then what is the point of your God if he can't bless love? Wow, we got here fast, Susie Ruffle.
I love it. But I think that that's an important thing. I mean, I think that you can't help. Let me speak for myself personally rather than say.
No, please speak for all of England.
Oh, okay, fine. I think that you can't help but be aware, even if when you're growing up like me, sort of going, I think a lot of this could be bollocks. And I'm sure there are people listening that don't think that it's bollocks, and that's great for them as well. But
yeah,
for me,
of course.
But I still can't help but sort of. Let me work out what I'm trying to say, because I don't know if I've ever said this out loud before, but, and you're not interviewing me, but here we go.
Susie exclusive. I'm here.
But I think I still somehow like seek the praise of like when I interviewed, although he's not Catholic, but when I interviewed the Reverend Richard Coles, I really wanted him to like me, because I was like,
oh, of course.
Well, you're like this, like you, maybe you've got something that I can't get, that I somehow can't tap into. And I guess that's the thing with like the Pope coming out and saying that about same-sex unions.
The Pope came out?
Yeah. So that's been very confusing for the whole... you're a news cycle behind. That's what's happened.
That's two exclusives you have just dropped on this podcast.
It's when like when you're in a writer's room and you haven't read the news the day before.
Oh, that's
Everything's changed.
Yeah. You've got a great pitch about Boris Johnson's speech and you don't realise that he's done something 10 times worse, like since then, you read the news.
I don't need the Pope to like me, you know. But when there was the thing in the summer where he was saying he was sort of pro-gay, and I was sort of relieved
it a bit
by
more
it
pro-gay, didn't it?
And I was relieved by it somehow, and I'm like, what's that linked to? Is that just because I am a desperate people pleaser and I want people to like me, whether they're in the Vatican or at the comedy store,
join the club?
Yeah, or is it because of growing up and having this sort of, I don't know, draconian religion constantly sort of spoken about every Friday when we were at Mass? Do you feel that?
I don't, but I do know that priests were sort of, it sort of went like all people, priests, then God. So, you know, in terms of like the sort of national psyche, is that what you would call it? And so it does make sense. And also, you know, we all kind of want to be praised a bit by authority, and we all want to be praised by parental figures. And, you know, weirdly, like, well, you have to call God our Father, and you have to, you know, in Catholicism, there's a whole prayer around that. And and so, yeah, no, it makes total sense from like a human being point of view. But actually, I actually just got a text from the Pope there, and he said, tell Susie, I think she's a great girl.
Great. I think he must have lost my number, so that's really really good.
So you can rest assured he liked you.
Well, I feel much better. Thank you, Bruno. It's always good to chat to you. I always forget that you've got the Pope's number. So growing up in that environment where you're at a Catholic school, not super Catholic at home, very academic at home, at what point were you because I know that you identify as bisexual. And so at what point did you, like, for you, did you think, oh, I'm interested in boys or I fancy boys?
Yeah.
And then did you go, oh, maybe it's girls as well? Or was it the other way around?
Yeah. It was very much the first way. And it's so interesting because I've thought about this. I've thought about it a lot now in recent years because you kind of have more perspective to look back over your early years, and also thought about it in the context of this podcast because, you know, you don't ever get this opportunity to sort of explore out loud what your journey was. But essentially, I hit, I don't know, 11 or 12, and I started to fancy boys. I went to an all-girls school. The boys were, I kind of only knew them from my road or from my drama class. And yes, all of those boys from my drama class are gay now. So I fancied them, and I had, you know, I didn't have many boyfriends like in my teenage years, but I had a few, and I only exclusively fancied boys. So I went to an all-girls school and did not for one second fancy a single girl in that school. I went to university and was still only fancying boys. I think I was in either my third or fourth year in university, and degrees are 4 years in Ireland, not because we're thick, just because that's how long it takes. This is the story that I told myself for a long time, and to a certain extent is still true. I went out with two gay friends one night to see a singer. And during the course of that show, I thought the singer, a female singer, was extremely sexy. I realized I fancied her. I realized I must be bisexual. And as soon as the applause happened, I said it aloud to my friends. So it was my experience that I fancied a woman, immediately said to my friends, I fancy a woman, I must be bisexual now, which is sort of why I've kind of historically have felt that I didn't have a coming out story, because I kind of felt like coming out was, you know, people, the full sentence is you're coming out of a closet. And for me, I had literally never stayed in the closet for one second, because as soon as I experienced the fancying of a woman, I articulated it. And from then on, I sort of thought I was bisexual and I fancied men and women. However, when I then go back over with that knowledge that I am and identify as bisexual, and by the way, my bisexuality is inclusive of people of all genders and trans people, just because there are some bisexuals that are stickler about that, so I want to be clear. Mm-hmm. So then when I looked back with that knowledge over my life, I was like, oh, that time I was 12 and I became obsessed with the woman who won the Eurovision. I don't know how old I was, but it was that I definitely fancied her. And then when I was 19 and I went back to see that play 4 times because I had that actress in it, I didn't just think she was a great actress. I fancied her. But, and here's the thing, I think I would have realized that I fancied women a lot sooner if I had any, and I literally mean any, bisexual role models, because I knew I fancied boys. So it did not occur to me for one second that I was gay, because my fancying of boys was real. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't something I was I was desperately trying to cling on to. It was real. I really fancied them. And I still do. So I therefore knew I wasn't gay. So I never had the time of being like, am I gay? Am I gay? And then when I essentially fancied women, I had no language for that. So I didn't recognize it as a crush. I just recognized it as like idolatry or admiration or, you know, that kind of thing. And I wasn't even visualizing myself kissing them or fantasizing about them, because I didn't really have, I couldn't see that anywhere. There wasn't anywhere on TV that I could really see a bisexual character. So as I say, it's only kind of with like the 2020 hindsight that I can go back and go, of course I fancied women like alongside boys from a lot younger than I realized. But as soon as I realized it, then it sort of became part of my identity and who I dated then. Then I dated men and women after that.
Really? So it was after just watching that one concert that you were like, right, yeah, I'm gonna date some women.
Yeah. And I think also then there was starting to be a bit more language about it. And, right, you know, I had learned that there was such a thing as bisexuality. And the only thing is that I guess there are still, you know, prejudices about all sorts of sexualities now. But the only way I heard bisexuals described was a pit stop to Gay Town. There was no such thing as bisexuals. People who said they were bisexual were really gay, but they were in denial. And that's why, again, I think I maybe didn't know for a while that I was, because I was so sure I wasn't gay. And so therefore I just didn't know there was another option, if you know what I mean.
But I think it's really important. It's why, you know, on this podcast, I try really hard to make sure that everybody feels like they have been, like there's a story that's a little bit like them. I try to make sure that it's, you know, as diverse as possible in every sense of the word. Yeah. But I think that that's something that has come up a lot on the podcast, is that more so women than men have said, I thought I was bisexual for a bit, or I was bisexual for a bit, or I thought being bisexual might be more palatable for a bit, which I think is something that is, it's quite tricky, because I don't want someone who is bisexual to hear that and think that I think that everyone that is bisexual will go on to be a lesbian. But also that is how some people work out their gayness.
Yes, exactly.
And I think you're absolutely right. Not having the role models. I mean, I was just trying to think as you were saying that, and I'm like, Alice in the L Word? Like, she was bisexual, I think? Or is it just that I know that Lisha Haley's bisexual? Like, it's... Or is she bisexual? Like, you know, and so... But you're absolutely right. Not having that language. And I think, again, and I'd be so interested for your take on this, Brianna, I think that sometimes being bisexual has been used to sort of sex up.
Yeah. Yeah.
Something or a pop star maybe saying it, or something like that.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, I as a lesbian find that really annoying, because I'm like, well, stop trying to cash in on the pink pound if you don't actually feel that. But how does that feel as someone that does identify as bisexual? How do you feel about that?
Yeah, well, it's interesting, because I used to be a lot... So I'm married now, and I'm married to a woman. And, you know, pandemic aside, I do intend on staying married to her.
So the marriage proposal for me at the top, it was just a joke, guys. Everyone knows.
Do you know what, Susie? Okay, let's put it on the long finger. And I do mean that sexually. But the reason why I bring that up is because people... And actually, we've been in a relationship for 11 years. And so when you're a woman who's with a woman, people immediately project gay or lesbian onto you. And when you're a woman with man, they immediately project straight onto you.
And I know I've also made a mistake when I've been with you girls and I've been like, come on, lesbos, or whatever, and you've been like, I'm a bisexual, and I'm like, thank you, Brona, I am sorry.
Well,
you're absolutely
right
to pull me up on that. But I think it's important that you do pull me up on that, because...
Well, I thought it was, but I'm actually going to retire it a little bit now, and here's why. So the reason why I was always so pedantic, if you will, when people would call me gay or a lesbian or straight, and I'd go, actually, I'm bisexual. Actually, I'm bisexual. And I would say it all of the time. It's because of that dearth, that absolute lack of bisexual representation that I had growing up. So I think I would have, as I've already said, I think I would have realized earlier that I was bi if I had any role models or knew that they existed. So for me, it was important to be visible and to talk about bisexuality so people knew it was a valid identity and not something that was a train stop on the way to gay town, or sexually promiscuous, or, you know, something made up. Now, I think people... do know that, and actually, like, you know, the conversation, the culture, everything has changed. So I don't need to be a one woman billboard for bisexuality. It's not going to make someone go, oh, bisexuals exist, if I correct them. And so now I think, okay, I don't actually have to say it all of the time. If people say, you know, if people want to say I'm in a lesbian relationship or I'm gay, I'll maybe tell them if it's relevant, but I don't need to take on the responsibility that nobody will know bisexuality exists unless I flag it up. So, sorry, that was just an aside. That wasn't the answer to your question.
I'm really pleased that you shared that.
So what I'm saying is, Susie, you're forgiven for calling me a lesbo. For that...
It was with a group of other gay women, and it was a term of endearment that I used for a collection. I think I called you a cardigan of lesbians or something like that, and it wasn't. It was a cardigan of lesbians and a jumper of bisexuals.
I think you called us a Doc Martin of lesbians. And we
a Birkenstock of dykes.
Yes, and we all were wearing Birkenstocks at the time. So it was accurate. But anyway, so that's a journey I've been on with that. In answer to your question about, like, bisexual representation in TV, it's an interesting line, because I think it's like, if it's bad writing and they have just done it to sex it up, then that's just going to feel like putting you one step forward, two steps backwards. If it's not, and it's a character who just happens to be bisexual, or they get a bisexual storyline, but it's good TV, then I do think that representation makes a huge, huge, huge difference. And I think everybody knows that. You know, I think, like, representation and authenticity of voice, and I mean that at every stage, you know, in the writer's room, in the casting, in the characters. I think if people can see a little bit bit of them, as someone who works in TV, if people can see a little bit of their own lives or themselves kind of reflected back, then that's going to be a much more impactful watch for them. And they're going to, and they're also might learn something about themselves. And I think I did, like, I mean, it took me a while to find the L word on Irish TV. But when I did, I think I did appreciate that actually, you know, Alice's character, it was Alice, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Oh my God.
I know, because I was in love with her.
Were you? Was she your girl?
Yeah.
Do you know who mine was? And this is weird. Nobody shares this. Do you remember Marina?
Oh, yes.
Yeah, I was obsessed with
Marina.
Of course.
Of course I remember Marina.
Everyone
no
would ask me who my L word crush is, and I'd be Marina, and they would be like, sorry, what? But obviously Bette as well.
Oh, of course. She's a that goes without saying.
Yeah, so I think the more representation, the better, unless it's really shoddy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, totally.
At which point, just make them straight. It's fine.
And so after this concert, who were you watching?
Oh, I can't say because I know her.
Oh, okay. Was it me?
It was you doing Molly Malone, Cockles and Muscles.
Thank you.
It was Madonna.
It was Madonna, who you
know. Really good friends. And oh, I just got a text from Madonna, actually. She says she thinks you're a great girl.
Oh, that's nice. Thank you. You've got all these text messages coming in.
I know. I shouldn't be looking at my phone during a podcast, but I am.
But I don't mind it if it's Madonna and the Pope. So after this moment of briefly being in a closet, I totally understand that you're saying you had these moments beforehand.
Yes.
And you told two of your pals. Did you then just tell everyone?
I think I did.
Were you so sure in yourself?
I think I did, because I didn't really, and I've been very lucky in this sense. I didn't, while there was people in my life who did have some kind of like fear and homophobia and those kind of things, I didn't have any internalized shame. So I think very quickly it became something I spoke about. I mean, I don't think I went on to properly date a woman for a few years, but it was something I was kind of now more open to and discussing. And except for a couple of conversations with my family, I can't remember telling a single friend that I was bisexual, which suggests to me that it was just something I chatted about like anything else. And like I always have been, and this is why it's probably both brilliant and extremely difficult to be married to me, but I always have been the kind of like, I'm Irish and I'm an actress, so I have an emotion and then I want to talk about it. So it's sort of like, oh, I've just felt something and now I'm going to articulate that, as opposed to, you know, kind of taking that and pushing it down. So I think I was very open. As soon as I had that realization, I was very open. I didn't really talk to my family about who I dated anyway. So I waited until I was in what I knew to be a serious relationship. So it had like, you know, a relationship with a woman, a relationship with a man, none of which I had told my family about. But when I met my now wife, and I knew instantly it was going to be serious, so I told my family about it after about 3 weeks, 3 or 4 weeks. That was like the closest I've had to coming out conversations, because there, as I've already mentioned, I was one of a family of seven, and there was one person in the family who had quite a significant journey with that and was very afraid and upset and confused. And essentially it was homophobia, but just disguised as a fear of being different. And then maybe one other person in the family that felt some of those things on a smaller level, but, would never say it to me. So just kind of worked that out by themselves. But then, you know, everyone in the family was extremely welcoming to Sue, my wife. And now they would almost deny that they ever had a problem with it. It's kind of been written out of history that that ever happened, which is, I think, what happens when people immerse themselves in knowing people who are different. So you can't, you know, because you can kind of have these fears about people of different races or refugees or queer people, or, and then you actually meet them, realize that it was all in your head. And then it kind of, I don't want to say cures you of your homophobia, but it's certainly like, you know, you certainly can have a journey with that.
Yeah, I have a very, I have a similar family member that had a journey and now has very little memory.
Yes, of
the journey they've been on.
Yeah, and it was interesting because that, like, you know, just listening to what those fears were, and it was really about what other people thought or what my life was going to be like. But it was also quite significant. You know, at one point, this person said to me, "If you love us, you will walk away from this relationship," and that's like quite a dramatic, you know, piece of emotional blackmail there. But I think I was protected by A, just being in love with Sue and being extremely happy and high on, you know, oxytocin and serotonin and, like, you know, just high on being in love. But I think also I knew, I think I always knew that what I felt wasn't dirty. Like, how could this, like, kind of what I was talking about earlier with the Pope, like, how could this beautiful connection and love that I was feeling for another person in any way be wrong? It didn't feel wrong. And I trusted my own instincts on that. And so I was therefore able to be quite separate from this person's journey, like being like, okay, you work it out. You ask me any questions. I'm here for you, but I'm not going to take on any of your shame. It doesn't belong to me and I don't want it. And so I was really lucky that that was my experience. And I think that kind of comes from just the age that I am and the work that everybody in the world had done for LGBT plus rights, so that, like, my understanding of it wasn't, oh, it's wrong, it's weird, it's wrong.
I love that you stepped away from that and said that you weren't going to take on that shame. I think that's just brilliant.
Thank you.
Do you think that the fact that you say you didn't have any internalized shame, which is quite an unusual thing to come up on this podcast, because quite often that's quite pronounced for quite a lot of us, or it can be. And do you think that is linked to the fact that you had that feeling and you spoke it straight away?
That's really interesting. That's a really interesting question. I think it must be. I think it must be that. And another element of it is the time and place that I, you know, realize my sexuality. And I think another part of it is a sort of an inbuilt arrogance that I've always had, which is, well, if I feel this way, it can't be wrong because, you know, it's me. So I think sometimes arrogance can mask insecurity. And so I sometimes err on the side of, like, making jokes about how brilliant I am when I'm feeling a little insecure. And I think that that was part of that. But I do believe as a person, and that, you know, and this is reflected in my friendships and my relationships, I do really believe in, like, in like emotional communication and, like, talking about how you feel. And I do think that only good stuff comes of that. Nobody ever kind of says, oh, I told a good friend about something I was worried about and now I feel worse. I mean, they might if someone really fucks up. But I think that's a huge thing if you can crack that in life. That, like, you know, that if you talk to someone you trust about something you're upset about, 9 times out of 10, you're going to feel better. And so I think that openness can really help with the stuff that we just push down and get afraid of, and give it this huge power, like the power of a rolling bit of moss. You know, it starts off small and then you push it down. So it gets bigger and bigger. And then you have to deal with this big boulder of moss. Don't know why I went with moss here. But so, yeah, I mean, I've never thought about it that way. So thank you for the realization. But I think that might have played a role for sure. And I also, I hope it's not too, as I say, kind of like arrogant and up myself to come on and talk about my lack of shame, because I think that, like lots of people have had very difficult journeys coming out. And it's very, like, you know, arrogant of me to come on and be like, yeah, no, I was fine. But I also feel passionately about it because I think that if you can teach kids that actually what they're feeling isn't wrong, and they don't have to wait if they don't want, you know, if they want to and need to, that's fine. But if they're 12 and have a crush on someone of the same sex, they don't have to wait until they're sure, like people tell them, or you're 12, you don't know, because being gay or queer is just the same as being straight. So if you're 12 and you're a boy who says you're allowed to say you have a crush on a girl, then you should be allowed to say you have a crush on a boy. And the more open I think we are about that, then the less shame people will feel. And so that's why I think even though I sound like a dick, I think it's okay to sometimes tell stories of, actually, I was fine, because that's not my shame. That's other people's shame. Do you know what I mean?
But I really have to stop you there, because I don't think that you sound like a dick at all. And I am delighted that you are telling this story on the podcast, because I think it's so important, because I don't want anyone to, you know, wrestle with the shame that I had to wrestle with. Yeah. The fact that you exist and that your experience exists is actually super inspiring and hopeful.
Oh,
and
I hope so.
Maybe a look towards the future, and maybe that, you know, maybe a podcast like this is not going to have to exist in 20 years because people aren't going to be searching for queer stuff to make their lives and their feelings feel normal. You know, in an ideal world, this podcast wouldn't exist because people wouldn't have to deal with it.
In an ideal world, we'd just have less Susie Ruffle. No, I don't want to live in that
world,
Susie. No.
I would have fewer podcasts. But But you know what I mean? Like, it's really sad that some people's journeys are sort of wrapped up in shame, and they do have to, you know, and it is, you know, in their mid-30s and, you know, or early 40s where they, like, actually really... Yeah. deal with it. But I think it's really important and exciting that that isn't your journey, and I love that you don't take on other people's shame. And I hope that, like, people that are listening to this, and I know we have listeners first of all across the globe in countries where they can't be themselves.
I was just gonna say, I desperately need to acknowledge my own privilege, and my privilege was being from, like, a middle class, slightly arty family, you know, in middle class school, like, in, you know, not in the 1900s, in now, you know, going to study drama at university, like, all of those things. I absolutely recognize my massive, massive privilege in that.
But I think that, you know, people that might live somewhere where they can't be themselves, I think that them hearing you is really great.
I hope so.
That somewhere they don't have to hold that shame.
Yeah.
You know, there is a place where you cannot hold that.
Well, I think I want them to know that, like, no matter what other people think, they can look inside themselves and go, hang on a second, how could this be wrong? How could loving another person be wrong? Like, that's it. I sort of want people to, like, rely on their own instincts.
Yeah, I think that's brilliant. Well, I mean, we're coming towards the end of the...
Let's do a double. Let's go for another couple of hours.
Let's go. I mean, I totally could. Did you have a lot of friends that were sort of already part of the LGBT or queer community when you were just dropping into conversation? I can totally guess with you it was just dropping into conversation that you were bisexual.
Yes, I think I did by then. But I think it's also important to realise that, like, I don't think I met a gay person until I was 16 or 17 in real life. And then, again, this speaks to
your life.
Yeah, in real life. I think I saw them on the television. And I remember, like, finding out that one of the, like, I was on, yeah, it was, like, someone on who, like, taught at a youth theatre where I went. I remember finding out that he was a gay man, and it blew my mind. I didn't think there was anything wrong with it, but it was like finding out that he had zebra stripes across his belly. It was sort of like, oh my God, really? Like, really? A real life gay person? Wow. And so that, you know, that was my journey. And then into, by the time you get to university, there's a lot more kind of, like, visibly gay people. And also, I do have to say that I love and use the word queer now, but when I was growing up, queer, people did use it as a slur for gay people, but it was also just a word for when things were a bit gone off. So, like, you would smell a yogurt and be like, no, I think that's a bit queer, actually. I think that's a bit queer. So when Irish people started using it, like, in the last 10 years or so, I was like, no, we can't reclaim that. It is a terrible word. No, I refuse to. And now I realize that actually it's so useful because you want something that includes everybody. And actually, it's a great word. It's just that it really brings to mind, like, gone off yogurt when I hear it. So I didn't.
Oh my God, Bryna, I think you do have some shame.
Yes. Oh my God, we found some. Yay. Come on, Out with Susie Ruffle. Find your shame.
Oh, thank you. Can you do the new advert?
Yes, I will. So no, I didn't until, like, my late teens, early 20s. And then I had loads. Yeah, obviously.
Yeah. And was it, like, was Ireland, and I'm only saying this because of the Catholic Church, but did Ireland feel like quite a homophobic place at that point? Because I know I've been to Dublin and there's great bars and there's a real sort of queer hub now, it seems.
But
I don't know what it was like sort of 15 years ago.
Well, it was, I can't remember the exact year, but it was in the 1990s that homosexual sex between two men was decriminalized. Like, it was a crime. It was still a crime in the 1990s. And so, yes, that pervaded all of society. But I do think that with the loosening of the worship of the Catholic Church, that then, and then also people, you know, sort of like role models, like media stars, being a bit more out and that kind of thing. But then it's hard to divorce it from my own experience, which was just like, you know, in the next decade, I was going to university and stuff anyway. But it does feel like, you know, and I went out to gay clubs a lot, actually, before I even realized I was bisexual, just because that was the fun place to dance. And so it was a great scene, and it remains just an amazing scene to this day. So I think I remember a family friend who's in his 50s, maybe pushing 60s now, he is absolutely traumatized by the Ireland that he grew up in. I would meet him in these clubs when I was out in my 20s, and he would sort of say, like, oh, do people in your family, do they know about me? And I would be like, I don't know. I don't care. Do you want me to tell them I saw you here? Like, I didn't really clock it. But I know that generation were absolutely abused by, society and the church and the law. Like, it's a huge thing. And I think, I don't know, where people will be listening to this from, but like, that is a horrible and huge trauma for the government of your country to say that your love is wrong. And, you know, like, women were never in that law in Ireland because, as you know, two women can't have sex. You know, so again, like, that was sort of female privilege in a way of being protected by that. But I think, I think Ireland has changed beyond recognition now. And we were the first country in the world to pass marriage equality by popular vote. And now Irish people are so proud of that. And it passed by I can't even remember. It was in the 90s, 90th percentile. It was incredible.
And if anyone hasn't seen it, there will be videos on YouTube of it when it got passed. And I mean, I just remember weeping.
I was there. I was in Dublin Castle. Yeah, I went home. I was in Dublin Castle courtyard when it was just incredible. I was so proud. So proud to be Irish.
Yeah, that was, I remember watching it on the TV and just, bursting into tears.
Oh,
just
because it's, thank you. Well, just, you're Irish, you know, so it was emotional for you.
Of course, it was huge for me.
Yeah, from the ruffles of Mayo.
This has been Brona Cuiva Titley.
Oh,
this has
so
been
good to see
you. such a joy, and thank you for
so lovely. Thank you so much for having me.
I know that you've listened to the show, so you know the final question of the show, and I'm thinking about the Brona who decided not to take anybody else's shame, but maybe someone's listening who's had a family member that is going through it at the moment or is scared about telling someone in their life. If you could sort of pick up the phone and give them, I don't know, a bit of advice from the experience you've had, what would you say to them?
Oh, it's such a lovely question. And I do know that you ask it. And I actually do have a piece of advice for younger me as well, if that's okay.
Yes, please.
Which weirdly is connected to shame, but it's not shame of sexuality. I think it comes from shame of the church. And my advice to teenage Brona is to have more sex, because I really, really thought it was something you could only do when you were married. And so I only slept with partners who I was in committed relationships with. And now that I'm in what will hopefully be my long, long-term marriage, I'm just like, oh, why did I do that? And I think it was because the church like really had some stigma around that. And me and my friends at Catholic school, we took that on. We were like, yeah, you know what? I'm not going to give that to someone unless they're really committed to me, because that is my little gem. And now I think, oh, that was shame, actually, Brona, and you can open your legs for a few more people if you want to.
Absolutely.
But in terms of somebody else who's listening, like, thank you so much for listening to this podcast, you out there. And I just want to reiterate what I said before, which is like, you are incredible. Like, the love that you have to offer another person is a beautiful thing, and you are the best in the whole world at being you. There is absolutely nothing wrong with you. Not only that, what you have is going to make your life richer, happier, better, more fulfilled. And you don't have to take on anybody else's bullshit around that. Doesn't mean you have to go and shout it on the rooftops, especially if it's not safe. I am not saying that. I am just telling you that you can go sleep at night knowing that you are pure and wonderful, and never, ever let anyone tell you different. And if they do, I will fucking kill them.
Oh, Brona, I wish you could have said that to 14-year-old me.
I think if I met 14-year-old you, I would have known I was bisexual.
Hashtag representation.
And we wouldn't have to have put our love on the long finger. Well, we would
there
have done,
go.
But just behind the sprinklers, behind the church. I got fingered for the first time behind a church, just to end on a nice full circle of Catholic shame.
Yeah, that's beautiful.
So good to talk to you, pal.
Oh, Brona, that was so good.
Thank you.
Oh, I just loved that episode so much. I think Brona's so brilliant. Check her out on all the social medias. And keep across what she's doing. She's just so great. If you want to get in touch, please do. The email is hello@outwithsusieruffle.com. Please tweet about the show, Instagram about the show. Leave a little review if that's the kind of thing you'd like to do. It's really helpful to get more people to find it so more people can listen to it. I hope you have a great week, and I'll chat to you next week. Okay, bye.